Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The country loves to look at Alaska, its fabulous coastline, its vast wilderness. But a century ago, there was no guarantee it would look so great today. Balancing exploitation and conservation was a real long battle, with names like John Muir, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and many more right in the thick of it. This hour on Point, historian Douglas Brinkley on how we inherited a beautiful, wild Alaska. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it, hiked it, cruised and kayaked in it? Do you know what it took to hang on to wild Alaska? And have we got the balance right today? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Douglas Brinkley, prolific author and historian, professor at Rice University. He edited the Reagan Diaries and has told the histories of Henry Ford, Dean Acheson, Jack Kerouac, Rosa Parks, Hurricane Katrina, and more. His new book is The Quiet World, Saving Alaska's Wilderness Kingdom, 1879 to 1960. Douglas Brinkley, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Well, nice to be with you.
We look at that great profile of Alaska, those mountains and forests and fantastic wildlife and streams, you know, surging with salmon, and we think, yeah, that's Alaska. Of course that's what it looks like. But your book tells a very different story, kind of tooth and nail fight over resources versus wilderness that went on almost from the very, very beginning. Was it a close call?
Very, very close call. The story really begins when the United States acquires Alaska from Russia. It's, Andrew Johnson's administration, but Secretary of State William Seward is most famous for making the purchase. And he got laughed at, as we all know, as Seward's icebox, Seward's folly. But by the turn of the 20th century, Alaska became very coveted. That's when Jack London's writing his Yukon and Alaska stories, because there was gold and then there are hills. Mm-hmm. And the gold rush to Alaska started a 20th century trend to come to Alaska, strip resources from the land and then leave. Don't develop sustainable communities, simply gouge and go. And I'm writing about, starting with John Muir, who discovered and wrote about the glaciers in what is today Glacier Bay National Park, wrote this beautiful wilderness journalism about the glory and joyousness of the Alaska glaciers, glacier fields. I then track, the whole story of the 20th century of the developers and the extractors versus really a wilderness cult that has a lot of poets and artists and key politicians, as you mentioned, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, and oddly, Dwight Eisenhower, joining the Save Wild Alaska movement.
How did Americans come to understand or take on these narratives out of Alaska? I mean, when you say gold and big, bold headline across the top of, the San Francisco Examiner, that kind of speaks for itself. How did they begin to see the other side of Alaska, the majesty of its natural gifts, as well as gold for extraction and later oil and all the rest?
I give a lot of credit to John Muir, who was the first great cheerleader and booster for really what's ecotourism. He told people, go to Alaska, see it, explore it. And it followed by a whole group of mainly friends of Theodore Roosevelt who would do explorations up there. There's also the U.S. government would do biological survey reports. When they'd come back to Washington, they were flabbergasted by the number of seals off in the offshore islands or the amount of grizzly bear they found in some places. But as every decade went on, particularly these huge lumber outfits and copper mining companies out of Washington State, Seattle, some from other places, came in and were just gouging the land. And so the federal government was constantly having to go in and do rear guard, really, actions to protect Alaska. Roosevelt, T.R., as president, created our two largest national forests, the Tongass and the Chugach National Forest. They're immense. Anybody who goes to Alaska mm-hmm. knows how spectacular they are. And that began this sort of preservation of Alaska. Today, we have the Arctic Refuge in the north. We have Mount McKinley National Park, Gates of the Arctic, The Aleutian Chain is the Alaska Maritime protected region. So the federal government would listen often to people like Ansel Adams, the photographer, Walt Disney, the cartoonist, and actually do some very dramatic, bold preservationist work in that territory turned state.
It's easy to take those beautiful, great expanses that you just described for granted today. Tourists go and fly over or hike through or kayak through, and it's absolutely wonderful. But you've got a terrific description here from back in, I think it was 1899, when the owner of the Union Pacific Railroad, E.H. Harriman, took a steamboat full of scientists and naturalists up north to Alaska, and in 1899, what they found there was anything but this kind of pristine picture that that we savor today.
Well, that's right. The Harriman Expedition, you see, after the purchase, it was just the extraction industries going into Alaska, like with the exception of Muir trying to save it and a few others. But the Harriman Expedition brought Muir and John Burroughs, the great Native American photographer Edward Curtis, people like Dr. C. Hart Merriam and George Bird Grinnell, great naturalist, all went up there, and they started inventorying the destruction that was going on. They did record the beauty they saw, but the big problem was with the canneries there. People were idea of salmon that was just to get as many as you can, as quickly as you can. So big salmon canneries would net rivers, or they would dam them to stop the flow of the salmon, and to make a lot of quick money, you know, and then leave the streams depleted. And it's the same thing you see with the oil industry of today. Let's go in there, grab what we can, and then leave. And it's been this mentality of some people that feel Alaska's a storehouse of natural resources that need to be opened up and taken, and another group of people that say, this is our great wilderness. This is an heirloom for our children and our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and we need to create national parks and forests and monuments with it. The federal government has usually been on the side of the preservationists and have done the right things. They have made mistakes. The Atomic Energy Commission in the 1950s dropped atomic bomb on the Aleutian Chain, and I write about a man named Sea Otter Jones, another government employee for U.S. Fish and Wildlife, trying to stop nuclear testing in Alaska. And with Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, moved up to Anchorage, got the Chamber of Commerce behind his plan, Operation Chariot, in the 1950s, to drop an atomic bomb on the Arctic so you could create a oil port up there. And a group of Native Americans and professors at University of Alaska Fairbanks, groups like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society, said no when they were able to prevent the Arctic from being blasted. But there's always a kind of drama up there because it's such a large landscape and there are riches in the land. And some people just can't live with the fact that we want to do like Theodore Roosevelt did, create a Yukon Delta Reserve and just deed it to wildlife. It goads people that think there's money there and it's being protected just for waterfowl or caribou.
It's so big and so majestic, it sometimes seems like it couldn't be overwhelmed. But, I mean, when you read these stories that you tell, like Project Chariot, they wanted to, blow up maybe nearly 2.5 megatons of nuclear bombs and devices to, blast out a giant harbor up on the North Slope. That's a large-scale intervention, even in a place as big as Alaska.
Well, that's right. And those are what I'm writing about as the band of conservationists that said no. One of the early heroes in my book is Charles Sheldon, a son of Yale University, joined Boone and Crockett. He actually made his money in silver mining in Mexico, but decided to be a naturalist, a faunal naturalist, and did these extraordinary reports from Mount McKinley, the Denali Wilderness, came back east after living in the wild, so to speak, with these very beautifully written papers, and fought tooth and nail to create Denali National Park. It originally got signed by Woodrow Wilson as Mount McKinley. It's, of course, our tallest mountain in the United States. But without Charles Sheldon coming back and fighting for it, it all would have been ruined over there. And then once we created Mount McKinley or Denali National Park, all Alaskans have a hatred of wolves. And more than any other animal, they want them exterminated from the planet. And it's deeply bred in the mentality of Alaskans. And so for the federal government, for a while, was having bounty in the state territorial government, bounty on wolves. The only good wolf was a dead wolf. But But this changes when Aldo Leopold writes a Sand County Almanac and talks about the importance of wolves in an ecosystem, how they actually make the, you know, a deer herd healthier. He was writing about New Mexican wilderness. But you started getting a sea change. And by the 1950s, I write about how a woman named Lois Chrysler wrote a book called Arctic Wild. And with her husband, Herb Chrysler, they lived amongst the wolves. It was much like Born Free in Africa with lions. And they raised these wolf pups. And Walt Disney got in the action and made a true life adventure called White Wilderness. And it became a big hit. And suddenly wolves were seen as much more than just vicious predators, but as a essential animal and even one full of humor and cunning, much like dogs. Chrysler went too far in the other direction, leaving biological traits of wolves behind in her sense of raising these domesticated wolves. But nevertheless, there's always been somebody up there that's had to rattle the Alaskans' insistence that the land is to be gouged and animals like wolves are to be exterminated from the landscape.
Douglas Brinkley, stand by. The new book is The Quiet World, Saving Alaska's Wilderness Kingdom, 1879 to 1960. Always this tension between those after gold and oil or those out to save wolves and polar bear and wilderness. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
That old white mountain, just a little southeast of Nome, where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. Way up north, way up north, way up north.
We're talking this hour about how we inherited such a beautiful Alaska, the long fight that kept so much of it natural and unspoiled. But there's always been that enormous tension between resources and wilderness there. Douglas Brinkley joins me today from Portland, Oregon, a great historian, author of his latest, The Quiet World, Saving Alaska's Wilderness Kingdom. Of course, in recent years, Sarah Palin has come to be a very prominent face of Alaska. In the TLC television series, Sarah Palin's Alaska, she travels the state, takes advantage of the great outdoors. Here's a little bit where she heads out on a caribou hunting trip above the Arctic Circle with her father, Chuck Heath, and friend Steve Becker.
He's coming right here. Just wait. Wait till he turns broadside and stops.
Okay.
Go ahead. Right. There you go, baby. There you go.
Okay, good.
There you go.
Okay, good.
Sarah Palin's Alaska. Douglas Brinkley, I've spent a fair amount of time on the North Slope. It seems to me there's not that much to shooting a caribou. They're pretty slow moving. They'll stand there and stare at you.
Oh, I went this summer with a friend of mine, Tom Campion of Seattle, and we went camping up in the Arctic Refuge, or what the oil lobby calls ANWR. It's our great wildlife refuge. Dwight Eisenhower created it on December 6, 1960, and it's just spectacular along the Beaufort Sea there. And we camped, and you wake up in the morning, and the caribou are just all around you. Mm-hmm. It's the great herd. You know, they migrate to 180 miles up there. And we are with the Imperial herd in the Arctic Refuge along the Hulahula River. And it's spectacular to see them. And they're very curious animals. They'll almost come up to you because they like to look at you and see what's going on. They keep a little bit of a distance. But, I mean, geez, with the scope gun, if I had brought one with me, you could have shot 100 of them. It doesn't take much hunting skill to shoot a caribou, particularly when you're being dropped by an airplane right in their midst.
I want to talk about the Sarah Palin view of Alaska and how it does or may not represent Alaskans over time. Maybe it does, but let's get some callers in here. Marcia in Belmont, Massachusetts. Marcia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I love your show.
Thanks.
My great-grandfather was one of the Rough Riders, and he was...
With Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
Wow.
And he was appointed to serve as the consul, which is like the ambassador, mm-hmm. to the Yukon Territory.
Oh, boy.
And went cross country and up to Alaska, and then over to the Dawson City, mm-hmm. and was there for 2 years. And I have this wonderful miniature gold pan that's about 2 inches across, and it is gold with the letters on it, and it's from the Zero Club.
What, zero as in
1902.
Okay.
But he inspired me. His letters inspired me. I've gone up there 8 times on business, and actually, I think my favorite time is winter time there because it is so serene and beautiful, even though it's only light from 10 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon.
Yeah, I know it well. Marcia, thanks so much for your call. You take us right back to that period of Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, you know, you talked about Chase Sheldon, who'd hung out with Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, and then he's in Alaska. Here's a guy who rode in the Rough Riders, and then he's consul to the Yukon. Take us back to that Teddy Roosevelt era. How did Theodore Roosevelt? You've written a whole biography of him. How did he look at Alaska, and what he found there?
He saw Alaska as our great last wilderness. And Roosevelt, by the 1890s, was concerned that we were deforesting the United States, that we were raping the landscape for short-term gains. And I write about in my book, The Wilderness Warrior, a couple years back, mm-hmm. TR saved over 234 million acres of wild America. He saw Alaska as a chance to get it right. What concerned Roosevelt, after he was a Rough Rider and came back and the gold rush was on there, TR did not like the gold rush seekers. He thought they were bonanza winners, that they weren't creating farm or manufacturing. They weren't being real citizens to any community. They were simply traveling up there, often very unkept. Roosevelt was always perfectly attired, and cleanliness is next to godliness. And he basically
of course he had a retinue and a trust fund.
Of course, there's an aristocratic side to that.
Yeah.
But he saw it as a lot of rabble rousers heading up there thinking they're going to get rich quick, and that's not how life is, that you have to educate yourself, build a trade, and have a certain kind of values. But in the end, he started thinking of Alaska sort of like Nova Scotia. He wanted to have medium-sized cities in Alaska that were surrounded by huge green belts and allow only local companies to run a cannery or pulp industry, local logging, because what he did not like was the huge corporate entities. And in fact, he left the White House, and in 1909 was in Africa when William Howard Taft fired Gifford Pinchot, TR's old chief of forestry, mm-hmm. over Alaska lands. Pinchot was whistleblowing that a Morgan Guggenheim syndicate, huge New York corporate and banking concerns, had gone into Roosevelt Reserves in Alaska, getting sweetheart deals with the government on coal, and coal was what oil is today. And they fired Pinchot for whistleblowing on Morgan Guggenheim. Pinchot went over to Italy, met with Roosevelt. TR came back and split the Republican Party in two over Alaska lands was the initial trigger issue, and created that famous Bull Moose Party in 1912. And if you read Bull Moose conservationist planks, you will find it is as progressive of environmental thinking as almost exists today, with the exception of not having the benefit of DNA and understanding species appreciation. So Roosevelt ended up writing in 1913, an essay about the book by William Hornaday, Our Vanishing Wildlife, mm-hmm. which drew a tombstone of all the animals that have been exterminated, the passenger pigeon, the great auk, the Carolina parakeet, on. And Roosevelt's rallying on behalf of wildlife protection and what is essentially the Endangered Species Act today. TR actually wrote to, you know, lose any kind of bird species is worse than slashing all the Rembrandts in the world.
What was his lasting legacy in terms of conservation in Alaska?
You can't go to the state without being affected by TR or FDR. I mentioned the Bull Moose Party. One of the leaders of the Bull Moose Party was a young Chicago hotshot named Harold Ickes. Ickes was an outdoors lover from Pennsylvania and ended up becoming Secretary of Interior for FDR, and has a huge impact on Alaska protection. But it's the Roosevelts, TR and FDR. I don't know what the 20th century would have been without those two. They were true outdoor conservationists. They understood the complications of forestry, the need for natural beauty and heirlooms in the United States. And Roosevelt, TR himself, as I mentioned, created these massive forest reserves there. We wouldn't have tourism going up the Inside Passage on those boats to see the glaciers and the Orca and the whole area around Juneau or Skagway or Haines would have all been decimated. There would be no Kenai Peninsula today. And in fact, Roosevelt created a moose reserve in Alaska called Fire Island, not too far from Anchorage. Mm. And when Harding came in, they abolished the moose reserve because Harding represented the extraction industries trying to kill Rooseveltian conservation, meaning government regulation, federal government laws. When FDR came in, he reinstated a federal moose reserve in the Kenai Peninsula, larger and better than the one that his cousin T.R. had. So the Roosevelts are really responsible, more than any other two political figures, for saving wild Alaska.
Let me ask about that. I mean, you just said there would be no Kenai Peninsula. Of course, it would be there. It might be different. How different if these measures had not been taken? I mean, I think some people will look at Alaska, maybe some of those who want to go in and take resources and say, look, this is so big. Nature is so strong. We could or could have gone in and done more, and it would have recovered and looked great. You know, what's the big deal? What would you say to that, Doug?
That the Kenai Peninsula would look like Haiti today, where I just went, and it's completely deforested. And deforested land is the single where any place in the world where there's poverty, disease, you will find deforestation. That we owe, we complain about our federal government and paying taxes a lot in this country. But I'm telling you, as an honest historian, we owe the federal government a thank you for the job they did in saving places like Wild Alaska with national parks, monuments, forest, and bringing federal game management to Alaska, because left to the Alaskans, they would have shot the place up. They would have denuded all the forest. They would have despoiled all the natural beauty. These were not people that went to Alaska for aesthetic reasons, for spiritual wandering with the backpack, for kayaking amongst the glaciers. I write about the tribe of people like the illustrator Rockwell Kent, who wrote a book called Wilderness, who went up there for that. And these weren't people going up there to build sustainable communities. Alaska was always about get rich quick. It's like Las Vegas. Get up there, get it, and go back to the lower 48 where you could spend your dough. And it's because the federal government owned Alaska. They didn't just buy it from Russia. It was federal territory till the late 1950s when it became a state, mm-hmm. that the federal government put very smart regulatory practices that you can only have so many canneries on a river. You can only timber a certain amount that you couldn't. You had to have license or game laws. But all of Alaskans, once they get up there, they were so far removed that they would just shoot what moved. And it's amazing what some of these federal agents that work for Biological Survey today, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or our forest rangers going up there, and they had to be the law and confront this kind of rogue, lawless element that had no clue about how to properly manage the land. The number one crime, wrote TR and FDR used to say, we can do as humans is to leave the land we work on worse off than we got it. That the point of conservation in Leopold's land ethic is to repair the land, to fix it, to make it better. So when you die, our children are inheriting a better place, not a worse place. And it's the enemy of the Roosevelts are short-term greed. Every time the economy dips in a difficult time, people wanted to gouge on the public lands. And it's the federal government that has said no. And so when we all pass, we at least, if it's a constant fight, but we at least know that our grandchildren will be able to go and explore the Aleutian Chain and see the great flocks of birds, or see the northern fur seal, or the walrus, or, you know, and experience living amongst the caribou, or just getting lost on a beautiful green and swift-moving Brooker River in our only temperate rainforest up there. It's been a fight, a real fight. And it's the neat part about my book is how sometimes the federal government's listened to poets and painters and writers and eccentrics' views on how to protect nature. One man named Bob Marshall went up there, lived in the Arctic, and came back promoting what it took till 1980 to get, but the Gates of the Arctic National Park, which is spectacular. And he wrote beautifully about the Brooks Range of Alaska, mm-hmm. which makes the Rockies look small.
Not everybody was there to take. Here's a little bit from the 2003 documentary Alone in the Wilderness. It's the story of Dick Prenocki, who went up to build in 1968 to build his own cabin. He lived there for 30 years on the shore of Twin Lakes.
It would be 11 feet by 15 feet. Its front door would face northwest, and the big window would look down to the lake. A pile of logs. Which ones to start with?
That wind puts you right there. Let's get a call from Gales Ferry, Connecticut. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. In 2001, I rode my motorcycle from Connecticut up to Alaska. I spent 4 months just riding around Alaska and trying to take in as much of it as I could. And my overall impression, I was struck of just how much the people have a conqueror's mentality, meaning that this is their land, their natural resources. Their entire economy is based upon consuming them, whether directly or through the tourism industry. And I guess the most striking experience I had was riding the haul road from Fairbanks up to Prudhoe Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I was really struck at how pressed the United States must be in its domestic oil production if it would have to extract oil from such a remote and rugged land. Really was striking to see.
That's a long ride on a motorcycle. Up the Alcan Highway, John?
Yeah, we went all the way up through British Columbia and all the way up to Alcan and dumped in through Alaska right through the top end.
That is epic in itself. Douglas Brinkley, John sounds on your wavelength, but what do you say to those people who say, look, we are hard-pressed when it comes to energy. There are a lot of resources in Alaska. You don't have to ruin the state, but to put it all off limits is unrealistic. You know, part of what we do is develop the country that we live in.
Well, absolutely, and let me make it clear, I have no problem with the oil industry operating properly in Alaska, but look it up. Anybody can go online right now when I'm talking, and I'll tell you, BP, you talk about what they did in the Gulf of Mexico, they didn't maintenance their own pipelines, and they had the worst spill in the Arctic tundra, but it's so far removed from, you know, CNN and MSNBC cameras that becomes a back page story, a huge BP environmental disaster. They don't know what they're doing in their facilities up there. The pipeline has been largely a good thing, and it's, you know, connected Prudhoe Bay in the north to Valdez in the south. But of course, you had the Valdez spill. You know, and the Valdez was a horrible event, and it shows some of the dangers of doing oil drilling there. But I have no problem with the pipeline. All we're, I think, trying to say is leave the wildlife refuges alone. They were fought for. The Arctic Refuge was 8.9 million acres by Dwight Eisenhower. It's our nation's largest wildlife refuge. It's where the polar bear den. It's a spectacular tundra of all sorts of prairie grasses and wildflowers. And it's a huge birding area. Leave it alone. It'd be like to go in what Shell has been trying to do is offshore drill off of the Arctic Refuge to destroy it. This is a Dutch company coming to ruin America's largest wildlife refuge saved by Dwight Eisenhower. And, you know, so these fights, I found out, have happened before. Theodore Roosevelt had to use an executive order to save the Grand Canyon from people wanting to get zinc, asbestos, and copper from it. So it's not a matter of developing Alaska. It's leaving the public lands alone.
Don't
molest the public lands.
Stand by for just a moment, if we would. Much more to hear. The new book is The Quiet World, Saving Alaska's Wilderness Kingdom. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You're a wise, young, ambitious man. Will you sell your father in a lawyer upon that claim? Now he's up there in Alaska, digging in the cold, cold ground. The greedy fool is looking for the gold I've never found. It serves him right, and no one here is missing him, least of all the newlyweds of Saginaw, Michigan, for the happiest man and wife in Saginaw, Michigan.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, talking today about how we inherited such a beautiful Alaska. Big truck headed up an ice road right behind us there. We're looking at the long fight that kept so much of Alaska natural and unspoiled with historian Douglas Brinkley. His new book is The Quiet World. Douglas Brinkley joins us from Portland, Oregon. Sharon's calling right now from Charleston, New Hampshire. Excuse me. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Douglas. Wonderful program. I'm enjoying every word of it. I call with an anecdote about Project Chariot.
This was the nuclear blast that was pointed toward the North Slope.
That's right, to dig a harbor at the edge of the Chukchi Sea.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for Stuart Udall, Secretary of the Interior. At the time Project Chariot was being proposed, the Point Hope Eskimos wrote him a long letter about how Glenn Seaborg and Edwin Teller had come to reassure them that even if they had to move out of their homes for a few months and go into mobile homes outside of Fairbanks, they could soon return to their hunter-gatherer lifestyle as they had always practiced it.
Just 2.3 megatons of nuclear explosion and then you'll be fine. What was Udall thinking, saying about all this, Sharon?
Well, he gave me this letter and he said, let's see what we can do about this. And the Point Hope Eskimos had had a tape recorder under the bed when these eminent nuclear advocates had been speaking. So they had already been able, in their by their own research, to refute what was being said. I learned that the Department of Interior played a crucial role in being able to grant a land use permit to the Atomic Energy Commission to conduct the explosion.
You mean it was permitted and it was permitted and ready to go, Sharon?
Well, no, it was not permitted and ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
The secretary would have to sign off on it.
I see.
But once I found out that he had that authority and told him, a great grin spread over his face, and he said, I think we've got this baby licked. And he did not grant the permit. The Atomic Energy Commission was incredulous. They had always had their permits granted. But in this case, it was the appeal of the Eskimos, of the scientists from University of Alaska and Canada, the Alaska Conservation Council, and, of course, people all over the country who raised their voices in behalf of the wilderness that Douglas Brinkley has been writing about.
Wow, we're right there with Stuart Udall and that moment. Sharon, thank you so much for that call. Doug Brinkley, what about this era, the Cold War, McCarthy years, and the tension there between what was going on, that on the one hand you have people who want to, you know, blast huge nuclear holes in the coast, and on the other hand you have Dwight Eisenhower eventually moving to create the Arctic National Refuge.
Well, what a wonderful treat to get that call, and thank you for your great work with Interior and with Secretary Udall, who in my opinion was the finest Secretary of Interior in U.S. history, working with Kennedy and Johnson. Look, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we had nuclear superiority in the United States up till 1954 when the Soviet Union got the bomb, and just like there was a space race, there was a nuke race. And the idea was testing, testing, testing. Well, the Aleutian Chain and the Arctic seemed very far removed. Hence, they became potential explosion spots. And at the same time in the 50s, you know, if you even spoke out against atomic testing, you were somehow a communist during the McCarthy era. Rockwell Kent, who I write a chapter about, wrote the book Wilderness. He gets charged as being anti-American in the McCarthy era. And he's really a kind of a libertarian guy, and he refused to cooperate with them. But a lot of the people fighting against the Atomic Energy Commission were considered anti-American. Eisenhower came in an odd and big way. His first term, he was all about development and atomic testing. But he won in 1956, and he got rid of a guy named Douglas McKay, who was a hardened developer, extraction guy, and put in a man named Fred Seaton as Interior Secretary. Seaton was a moderate Eisenhower Republican from Nebraska. He actually owned newspapers in a lot of Midwest cities like Deadwood, South Dakota, or Lawrence, Kansas, and cities like that. And Seaton and Eisenhower oversaw a miraculous thing. Ike decided to lead the way and signed a treaty for Antarctica. That's why today we don't develop Antarctica. There became an international treaty to demilitarize it during the Cold War. It was a marvelous—he wanted to see it as a peace zone, Eisenhower, the Antarctica. Now, Alaska was different. Eisenhower was opposed to Alaska becoming a state because he thought it was would lead to two new Democratic senators, which it did.
Yes.
But when he signed it, the statehood, he told people to pick out the Alaskans, pick out lands they wanted to develop. Well, most Alaskans went to copper lands, timber lands, and they left the Arctic alone. There was nobody knew there was oil in the Arctic Refuge in 1960, 58, 59, 60. So when Eisenhower created three wildlife refuges in Alaska, there weren't a lot of squawks about it. The Fairbanks Daily Miner even allowed the Arctic Refuge to be created. It's not till 1967, 68, when oil's found there, that the oil lobby came in and said, we want that land. And the conservationists said, tough. It's the great crown jewel of U.S. fish and wildlife. And you had this inherent tension there. But Udall is a big hero. When he comes in 61, it's a game changer. And the person in my book who's the most powerful presence is William O. Douglas, Supreme Court Justice, who went to the Arctic on the Skenjack River in 1956 with Olus and Marty Murray, mm-hmm. came back and wrote brilliantly from his Supreme Court about the Brooks Range of Alaska. And in 1960, the very year the Arctic Refuge is saved, Douglas wrote a book called My Wilderness, demanding that we keep these roadless areas, wilderness areas, as a democratic right. And I don't think a lot of what happened in the saving of the Arctic could have happened without Douglas being behind-the-scenes leader in Washington, D.C.
He wrote, when roads supplant trails, the precious, unique values of God's wilderness disappear. I mean, this was a big part of those you call the wilderness believers. There was something that went all the way to the soul of humankind they saw at stake in Alaska.
Well, that's right. And Douglas was a champion of them. You know, he, for example, in Washington in the 1950s, wanted to save the C&O Canal. Everybody thinks it's a wonderful asset today. They jog the towpath and all, but it was supposed to be a freeway. And Douglas, who had polio as a child growing up in Yakima, Washington, was told he would never be able to walk, led hiking campaigns down the C&O Canal. He hiked 186 miles like a Pied Piper. And I interviewed or talked to Bobby Kennedy Jr., who went on one of those Douglas's walks. Bobby Kennedy was very close to William O. Douglas. And they saved the C&O Canal. And then Douglas went and saved the Olympic Peninsula, the great beaches of Washington, and helped save areas around Kings Canyon in California. I mean, he was a true, he was the most important conservationist in America, in my opinion, after Theodore Roosevelt. It's William O. Douglas, and somebody needs to start put out a volume of his nature writings. Douglas on alternative fuels in the 1950s, you would think it was written today. He just writes better than anybody writes today. But he had our number. He was prescient. History has been nasty to Douglas. And in the future, I predict 40, 50, 100 years from now, he's going to be seen as an environmental prophet.
I want to talk about the role that some important women played in preserving what we see in Alaska today. Here's some tape of Alaskan bush pilot Ginny Wood. She's featured in Ken Burns' 2009 documentary, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. She was a member of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots during World War II, went on to become a bush pilot in Alaska, devoted her life to fighting for Alaskan conservation.
Most people ask, what brought you to Alaska? But the question to ask is, what made you stay? We just fell in love with the country. The country told us what it should be and what it shouldn't be. I think that being out there was a little bit like Conrad said of the sea. It's not for you or against you. It's just very unforgiving of errors.
Yes, it is, especially midwinter. I know it well from time there. Douglas Brinkley, what about women who were a big part of important roles in this history?
Well, Ginny Wood, who you just played, I spent a wonderful afternoon with her. She lives near the university in Fairbanks, back in an incredible little grove in this wonderful kind of log home. And she is an icon and a treasure of Alaska. She came there as a WASP pilot with Cecilia Hunter, her friend. And these were women that during World War II were flying supplies places. They ended up in Alaska, and they opened up the Denali Lodge down at Mount McKinley to have real nature, you know, tours and things. Their big moment in history comes, though, when wanting to stop this nuclear bomb that we're talking about, Operation Chariot, and to save the Arctic Refuge. And they created a grassroots organization called the Alaskan Conservation Society. And because they were in the tourist business, they had a mimeograph machine. And also, Ginny Wood knew everybody in Alaska. So she would call people that weren't that keen on an Arctic Refuge and said, come on, you need to do that. And they would do it as a favor for Ginny Wood because they loved her so much. And it really helped the Eisenhower administration push forward these reserves because Secretary of Interior Fred Seaton, like all Interior Secretaries, want to see there's grassroots support for a national park so it doesn't or a wildlife refuge. They don't want to feel like it's the federal government imposing itself on a people. So Virginia Wood, going to congressional testimony and the like, really was able to pay a crucial grassroots role. But a woman that I write about in the quiet world is familiar to most listeners, Rachel Carson. And we talked about the fear of atomic fallout. Well, she was questioning the chemicals and pesticides. And, you know, the DDT was really vicious on bald eagles. And there was a combination of DDT, and there is a bounty on all eagles in Alaska. If you saw one, you shot one.
Why?
Because the fishermen thought that they were competing for fish. And so they wanted rid of them because they were stealing their fish. So they was almost went extinct in Alaska, the bald eagle. But due to Silent Spring of Rachel Carson, which was first published in The New Yorker in June of 1962, there became this effort to save Alaska from pesticides and DDT. And because it's such a prop plane society up there, they were just dumping chemicals all over Alaska. And so Rachel Carson and Ginny Wood, Marty Murie, who we could spend a whole program on, who lived all the way to 1980 and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Honor from Jimmy Carter. She's another one of the great heroes. She was married and went on her honeymoon by dog sled in the Arctic.
Wow. Women at the heart of the Alaskan conservation movement. I want to talk a little more about a woman we mentioned at the top of the hour. If you go back to the 2008 Republican National Convention, this phrase, drill baby drill, was first used. Rudy Giuliani used it. And then Sarah Palin helped popularize it, used it, in the 2008 vice presidential debate again against Joe Biden. She was still governor of Alaska then. Let's listen.
The chant is drill, baby, drill. And that's what we hear all across this country in our rallies because people are so hungry for those domestic sources of energy to be tapped into. They know that even in my own energy producing state, we have billions of barrels of oil and hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of clean, green natural gas.
Sarah Palin celebrating the drill, baby, drill chant. Douglas Brinkley, we've talked about conservationists and women in Alaska. How do you see Sarah Palin in this sweep of history and that kind of push?
Well, she's a very minor figure in Alaska. The powerful person in Alaska is Lisa Murkowski. And while we're on the opposite side, I think we have to leave the Arctic Refuge alone, and Lisa Murkowski wants to drill it. Murkowski, to her credit, is a land custodian. I mean, when there's a leaking on any pipe up there, or the oil industry is really damaging a landscape, Murkowski moves pretty quickly on investigating it. I'm not suggesting she's a prototype environmentalist, don't get me wrong, but at least she's talking about the issues about development and the need to make sure Alaska stays pristine and wild. Palin is just a mouthpiece for the oil industry. Her husband used to work for BP. They're just about kind of reckless opening up of public lands. They hate the federal government. It's a sort of a weird Alaskan group of people that don't want – they take a lot of money from the federal government, but they denounce it a lot. So it's at the core of what Palin is about is complete deregulation of the oil industry and opening up all of our public lands. I think she is a personal steward of the land. I have no doubt that or no reason to believe that Sarah and Todd Palin don't take care of their own property and want to see Alaska clean, but they just don't get the fact that you've got to have rules and regulations or otherwise the land gets destroyed. They're basically anti-science people. They don't believe in Darwin. They don't believe in that there's a proper way to manage the landscape. They believe that God put copper in a mountain to get it out, and whether you have to dynamite the mountain or you've got to go ruin the Arctic to get it, there are resources that are meant to be extracted. So there, she represents a kind of it's certainly a powerful view. Many Alaskans share her view, but most of the conservative Alaskans are more Lisa Murkowski. They are concerned about their land being contaminated. There is a sort of state pride in the caribou herd, and people don't want to see chemicals on the tundra. But most Alaskans are more towards Palin, the Drill Baby Drill, than what I'm talking about, the Save, Save, Save group of activists and political leaders.
Douglas Brinkley, his new history celebrates the decades-long effort by conservationists to give us the Alaska we see today. It's The Quiet World, Saving Alaska's Wilderness Kingdom, 1879 to 1960. Douglas Brinkley, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll go out with Michelle Schacht, Anchorage, 1988. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
It's kind of funny. Texas always seems so big, but you know you're in the largest state in the union when you're anchored down in Anchorage. Hey girl, I think the last time I saw you was on me and Leroy's wedding day. What was the name of that love song you played? I forgot how it goes.